Morning.
Good morning.
Lovely to see you.
Wow.
I walked over here this morning, probably about the 5,000th time, maybe 4,000th time I've walked over to this place from my house. It was raining on me. I was a little concerned, like, what if I get soaking wet? I was also very happy just to be on this planet, doing something I'd never done before. And just trying to recall my vow that we can do what we're doing so that everyone can be free from suffering. Pretty simple. So I want to talk today. I wrote a talk called Reflections on a Pilgrimage to Japan. So I went to Japan for most of April and I came back and like 77 people said, I want to hear what happened. So, and I want to tell you what happened because it was really wonderful. And I just met a lot of really sweet people and saw many beautiful things. And this talk will really focus on some people. And I went. I'd never been to Japan, and the Sotoshu is means Soto school. So Sotoshu is the largest Buddhist denomination in Japan. So Soto Zen, the kind we are, they have something like 14,000 temples. It's a massive institution with very complex regulations and lots of resources. And I don't know almost anything about it because we're not formally affiliated with Sotoshu. So Katagiri Roshi, who came here to found this place, was a Sotoshu priest, but he did not emphasize that this place should continue to have a relationship with any kind of formal relationship with Sotoshu. Although we are registered as a temple with the Sotoshu, none of the temples here, none of the teachers here are authorized as teachers by the Sotoshu. So we are authorized through a lineal transmission. Katagiri gave Dharma transmission to many people, including Karen Sunim, who gave transmission to Tim Burkett, who gave transmission to me. And this has been one of the ways that the built Soto Zen culture over 1,000 years or so. So anyway, I didn't know much about Sotoshu, but they're like, we're inviting Westerners to come here for a big celebration, 700th memorial anniversary of Keizan Zenji. So many people in Soto Zen know about Dogen Zenji, who was kind of the original founder. But Dogen was kind of like a freaky hermit who wrote beautiful things, but had a pretty small contingent of people. And a couple generations later, Keizan Zenji came along and was like, we're going to bring this to the people, and was really the propagator of the Soto Zen tradition. So Keizan, although maybe we talk about him a little bit less, was really, really important. Certainly we would not be sitting here without Keizan Zenji and his enormous efforts. So anyway, they're going to have this big celebration. I thought, well, that's kind of an invitation for me to go to Japan. I participated in that, which was, there were a lot of people there. And but before that, I thought, well, if I'm going to Japan, I should go have some fun. So I went on a vacation with my spouse, and that was really lovely. And prior to that, I spent about 7 days traveling with my friend Koshin Paley Ellison, who's one of the founders of the New York Zen Center, and a bunch of his students. So I said, I want to go to Japan, but I don't know anybody. And I was talking to Koshin, and he said, well, I'm going to visit my teacher and a bunch of other people. Why don't you come with me? Actually, I may have invited myself. In fact, when I said halfway through the trip, I think I invited myself. He said, yes, you did. So anyway, we were close enough that that wasn't a disaster. So anyway, most of what I'm going to talk about is that time that I was traveling with Koshin and those folks, and meeting his teacher, Kojima Roshi, and Shundo Aoyama Roshi. So Koshin decided he wanted to have a teacher. Although he's had transmission for a long time and founded a very big Zen center, he thought, I really want to connect to the tradition more. I want a teacher. So he looked around and he formed a relationship with this abbot from Japan named Kojima Roshi. And so we went to visit Kojima Roshi. And he has a family temple in a small city in Japan. And it's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful building that is incredibly well cared for. And it's been in his family for five generations. So the majority of Soto Zen priests in Japan are men whose father was the abbot of a temple. So the predominant way people end up being Soto Zen priests in Japan is that you are the eldest son of a father who was the abbot of a temple, which is a little different than around here, I think. We think of like Soto people are like called to be here. But generally speaking, the leadership is a lineal transmission of family members. And then the congregations are predominantly people who come and have funerals at the temples, or maybe on occasion come for particular ceremonies that honor something like Kanon Bodhisattva. So it just, to be there was like, oh, this is different. And I already had met people who, the same thing, like, my other friends who are Japanese Soto Zen priests, both of their fathers were Japanese Soto Zen priests. So when we got there, it was a wonderful relationship. Many wonderful things happened. It was incredibly fun. And he has a little baby, so that's really fun. But something that came up is we just talked a lot about our lives, and he talked quite a bit about how much pressure there was for him to become the abbot. So by the time he was like 8 years old, everywhere we go, people would talk about he was going to be the abbot of this temple. And he was like, I did not like it at all. And I was very resistant and it felt really heavy. He was like, try and go on a date with a girl and everyone in town knows you're the future abbot. Wow. So he like eventually said, I'm not doing this. And his father was like, that's okay. You don't have to do it. And he went on a business career and then he changed his mind. Now he's an abbot and he seems to really enjoy the work and really enjoy serving his community and has completely embraced, it looks like, his position. This whole thing of like the lineage, the family transmission of temple. So some of you may know we have like joint services with the Twin Cities Buddhist Association, which is a predominantly Japanese American community. We do that once a year. And Chiemi, who's the minister there, whenever she does a presentation to a group for the first time, she puts up an image of her home temple, which has been in her family for 400 years. And she says, I'm something like a 27th generation temple minister. And when Kojima Roshi took us out to dinner, it's his lunch in his hometown at a little ryokan restaurant. And the woman came out, and before the food all got laid out just beautifully. And then she said, this ryokan has been in my family for 500 years, and I'm a 27th generation innkeeper. So just it's just different, and it's useful to understand how different it is. I can think things are one way, and I'm always wrong. That's actually the essence of Mahayana Buddhism. If you think things are one way, you are wrong. So it's useful to actually have concrete examples of like, that's different. As manifested by people and other things as well. So while we were there, we were having tea. It was very nice. He said, oh, in 15 minutes, just be ready. A whole bunch of people are going to come here. We've opened up the Kanon altar, which is only open for a week. So Kanon is the Bodhisattva of compassion. Clearly, next to maybe Jizo, the most revered religious image and figure in Japan. I mean, Kanon figures are all over the place. The idea that there is a vast compassion that's embodied in female form is deeply meaningful to people there. So once, like, there's this period during the year where temples open their Kanon altars and people go and they will visit 33 temples in a span of a week, and they get little stamps. They make a pilgrimage to go and visit Kanon. And so he's like, yeah, well, some of these people are coming here. They're going to come. We'll do the chant. We'll give them the stamps. And then they'll leave. And that's it. So we went in. We chanted the Heart Sutra with these people, the same Heart Sutra that we chant here 5 mornings a week. And it was very nice. And some of them were completely disinterested in the fact that there were 8 Soto Zen priests who were from North America, only one of which was of Asian descent. Some were like, whatever. And some were kind of like, what? And we had some bows, and then they left. That was it. It was very sweet. The practice was chanting, and the practice was going and honoring the embodiment of compassion, which I've done here thousands of times in the morning, bowing my head to the floor in front of this altar, this bodhisattva of compassion. It's very beautiful. So we were planning to go to Kyoto with Genji Kojimaroshi, who's going to show us around for a day or two. And we were going to leave the next morning, and he gets a call when we first got there, and he sort of was like, I really got to talk. He disappears for a while, and he comes back and says, oh, I've got a funeral. There's no way I can get out of this. I will have to cut the trip short, but I'm going to find a way to come with you no matter what. So I saw two things here that I saw many, many times in Japan. An absolute commitment to hosting people and taking care of your obligation. So he ended up driving like a long way back and forth for like to hang out with us for like 4 hours because he had said, I will host you in Kyoto. And many other people did similar things. His father drove an hour and a half out of the way, both ways, to come and give us a gift and talk to us for 10 minutes. His father is the president of the university and the former abbot of the temple. So anyway, the other thing is funerals are big. When I was at Sojiji, which is next to Eheiji, one of the two main training temples for Soto Zen, we were doing a tour and we walked through. We got to the hall where they do funerals. And the guy giving the tour said, oh yeah, I usually do the funerals. I do 13 a day. And I can tell you my throat is raw because this is actually one of the main functions of Soto Zen temples in Japan. People were formally made to affiliate with temples a couple hundred years ago by law. And somehow through that system, people have long-term family connections to temples. And it is a total expectation that all funerals will happen there, and they're a big deal. And they're, you know, they'll be. We have one memorial tablet here for Katagiri Roshi on the founder's altar. There are halls there with thousands and thousands of memorial tablets stacked row upon row. So anyway, he was doing what he had to do. He took us into the Founders Hall, so our Buddha Hall, we call it the Buddha Hall, but it has a Founders Altar, which has Katagiri's memorial tablet on it. And 5 days a week, one of the priests here comes in and makes bows to that altar first thing in the morning, which is pretty standard Soto Zen practice. So these things, by the way, if you want to be really cool, you can call it Kaisando, which is the Japanese name. Anyway, we went into the Kaisando for his place, and he says, oh, that's my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, that's my aunt, and many family members in there. And he said, this is where I come to do Zazen, because no one else is allowed to come in here. I mean, not really no one else is allowed, but temples in Japan and actually in Vietnam as well have increasing levels of privacy. And the Founders Hall, the Kaisando, is one of the most private spaces. So you might be invited, you know, if you just show up, you can walk into like the public space. And then if there's a certain kind of ritual, you all go in there. But there are places that are more sacred and more private. And the Kaisando is very private. And he says, I can come in here. And when I have a few minutes, I practice Zazen. And it really helps me. Because he's really busy serving his community. They put a lot of demands on him, but he seems to approach it with great spirit. I said, how do you keep this place so clean? because cleanliness is so fundamental to the Soto Zen culture. I've seen him give beautiful talks about how he is taught to clean at AAG before. And he said, when I see dirt, I clean it right away because I know I'll never have another chance. It's like, is this a Zen teaching? What are you doing, Kojima Roshi? What are you doing? So anyway, it was just wonderful. He's just a warm. We just had a lovely connection. It's great. So after that, or maybe before that, we went to visit Shundo Aoyama Roshi. We managed Koshin, because he has a lot of really good connections, managed to arrange a tea with Shundo Aoyama Roshi, who is the highest ranking woman in Soto Zen history. Her title is Master of the Western Hall, and she is one of the only people who teaches at the two head temples, both Eheiji and Sojiji. And you might think, well, that sounds pretty good, but why is there a highest ranking woman in Soto Zen history? Wouldn't we just have so many that were high ranked that we wouldn't have to have one? But in fact, Soto Zen has long been, as almost all Buddhist institutions are, very patriarchal. Anyway, there's a great book about all the efforts she has made to move through, I guess, well, I'll just use the term glass ceiling in Soto Zen over the last 70 years. She's 91. She entered a convent when she was 5. And she is really something. I will tell you, Shundo Aoyama Roshi is really something. So she's been abbess at the temple, the Nisodo in Nagoya that we visited, for 50 years. And Kojima Roshi's father visits her like every few weeks. And so when we were at the tea, she said, oh yes, Kojima Roshi. Yeah, his dad comes and visits me all the time. He's great. So we were talking to Kojima Roshi a couple days later, and we said, oh yeah, you know, your dad is friends with Shundo Aoyama Roshi. He said, what? He's not her friend. She's a national treasure. He's basically like, he gets to visit her. I think social rank is a little bit more recognized in Japan than it is sometimes in the US. One of the things that Shundo Aoyama Roshi wanted to talk about a lot was her close relationship with Katagiri Roshi, the founder of this temple, with whom she went to college and who she said was one of her early and strongest supporters throughout her career, moving up and pushing through barriers to her authority in Soto Zen. And he was, in fact, the first person to ever bring her to the United States. She's only come twice, and one time was at the invitation of Katagiri Roshi, which just warmed my heart. You know, I've never heard anyone talk about it a great deal, but Katagiri Roshi had something like 14 Dharma heirs, and something like 5 of them were women. He came from a place where that was not by any means the norm. By the way, I just want to mention that at the end of the trip, we saw a great talk by Galen Godwin, who is she's the president of the U.S. Soto Shu arm, about how Dogen Zenji and Keizan Zenji were very clear. She had well-documented evidence of how much effort they made to move women into higher ranks of leadership within Buddhism in their time, and then kind of how that was foreclosed about 100 years later, and, you know, ongoing efforts to kind of move forward. Anyway, Aoyama Roshi is into Zazen. She's into, yes, the kind of practice, a little bit more like what we're doing here. So she is famous for running a very strict temple where there's a very strong Zazen schedule, where people are trained to meticulously care for the environment, where they study the Dharma, where they're not doing funerals, where they're not teaching people how to do huge amounts of complex rituals, but a much more what scholars will call modernist Buddhist practice. And she is fiery about it. So at one point, remember I said, like, at one time, all the community, all the families in Japan were forced to have a temple affiliation by the government. That's called danka. And she said, danka is like not still in practice, but the influence kind of is. And she said, danka and these funeral temples, it's not even Buddhism. She tended to be willing to make strong proclamations. It's not even Buddhism. It's like, oh, okay. We're doing the real thing. Get up and we practice zazen, we do the soji, which is cleaning, and we care for the grounds, you know, so forth. We practice in silence. We commit to the original vision of Dogen Zenji. So I mentioned this to Kojima Roshi. I said, yeah, you know, Shundo Aoyama Roshi said that, you know, this funeral temple kind of thing, which is pretty much kind of what he's doing to some degree, is she's like, she's not even Buddhism. A testament to how close I already felt with him. Because I normally wouldn't. That sounds obnoxious. But we were, even in 2 days, he was so warm and so open that I felt I can ask him this challenging question. He said, oh, yeah. He said, my job is to serve my community. The people in my community need my help when their family members die. And when they come here to make offerings to their ancestors during ceremonies, they do it without expecting anything in return. They just come with gifts because they want to give with no gaining idea. Which for those of you who know your Soto Zen, no gaining idea. Basic premise that Shizuki Roshi kept trying to instill in how we practice zazen and how we live. So, very different views. Imagine that. Kind of like people have different views. I want to read you a little bit of Shundo Aoyama. So this is a book, it's quite good book called Zen Seeds. I just want to show you Aoyama Roshi because she's so cool. I can't even tell you. She's 91, came in on a walker. Her students helped her into her chair and helped her out when she left. I don't think she could hear us almost at all. And she just held forth for an hour and a half. But like it was like Dharma rain, but kind of like a hard rain. A Dharma hard rain. It was great. Anyway, I'm just going to read you a little something from it. This is from a chapter called A Brocade Cannot Be Woven in One Color. And I don't know, some people are attuned to fabric, but brocades are popular in Japan. And it's a kind of a fabric that has a lot of texture and many different colors. Sometimes they'll have images, like you could make a brocade that looks like flowers. And there, people buy rakusus. By the way, all the rakusus are purchased there. We sell it in case. Anyway, so, there's often a pattern. And it could be a representational pattern, maybe just a pattern. Anyway. A brocade cannot be woven in one color. She writes, trying to have everything in perfect order is the way of inferior persons. Oh, jeez. She's kind of tough. Trying to have everything in perfect order is the way of inferior persons. It is better to have some disorder. When everything is carefully regulated, it's boring. Are cherry blossoms to be seen only in full bloom? Is the moon to be seen only without clouds? We arrived at the peak of cherry blossom season, and it is really something to be in a major industrialized city where everywhere you go, people are pausing in the street and just like smiling and looking at trees. Everywhere you go. But, as she points out, it's cherry blossom season. What about the rest of the year? She goes on later to say, life goes on without regard to our partial or selfish desires. Accordingly, joy and anger, sadness and happiness, love and hate, and all kinds of thoughts and emotions are woven together. If everything, including misfortune, illness, and failure, is unconditionally accepted as it is, then all experience may be constructively enjoyed. And here she's talking about the brocade. This brings to mind a phrase from the Book of Equanimity. A woven brocade contains all colors. Birth, old age, illness, and death, as well as happiness and misfortune, gain and loss, love and hate, all these are important tools for weaving the brocade of human life. A brocade cannot be woven with a single color of happiness. Given time, place, and occasion, everything contains all colors. It is in this way that the Pure Land, the other shore, is made manifest. Yes. To just meet sadness with compassion, desire with compassion, hatred with compassion. Is it yours? Or is it someone else's? Those distinctions are not ultimately real. They may have utility. They may have utility, but any emotion can be met with compassion. Seen as part of the brocade. I was like, so my spouse and I really love at this time of year to walk along the shore of the lake looking at ducks and goslings because they are cute. So it's just fun. It's fun, especially like, you know, the little mallard, when they first come out, I mean, they're about this big, bright yellow, and they're so goofy. It was just really fun. So we just walk around, and then when we see some, we stop and hang out. It's great. And we saw some just the other day. I saw the first mallard ducklings just a couple days ago over by Pimento over here. And we were enjoying them. I don't know, it's maybe two parents and five or six ducklings. And it was fun. But I mean, so many times, so many years, we've met one family. We'll see the same families day in and day out because we come back almost every day. And it'll be like eight, and then they're six, and then they're four. Quite common. You know, I don't even know. I think turtles eat ducklings. Hawks maybe eat ducklings. Foxes eat ducklings. Other ducks of duck ducklings, I think. I'm not sure. But I know that they go. And, you know, oh, sad. Sad. I feel sad. I feel, oh, what do those parents feel like? Oh, my gosh. Well, it's easy to forget the fox. Do I want the fox to die? And it's easy to forget that, like, the now that is like, oh, the cute ducklings is entirely dependent on the winter when there are no ducks here and there are no ducklings. There's ducklings that turned into gangly, weird looking, funny guys and then grew up and were full sized. The brocade, the whole thing, inescapably contains suffering and harm, generation passing away. And it is a peculiar capacity that I think we all have, that we can say, given that is like this, what can I do that will help all these beings be free from suffering? I have no idea whether only humans have this capacity. That is way beyond my ken. But I had an enormous faith and conviction that human beings do have it. So I never eat ducklings, for example. How do we eat? What do we eat? What do we consume? What do we say? These matter. These matter. Brocade of many colors cannot be woven with a single color. So I got to visit both Eheiji, which is the kind of the, to me, the most famous Soto Zen training temple in Japan, and Sojiji, which should be, but it's just less famous here in the US for some reason. It's actually bigger. And Eheiji is very beautiful. It's up in the mountains. So it's the place that Dogen Zenji founded when he left the area of Kyoto behind and said, I'm going up in the mountains and we're doing this for real. And the locale is incredibly spectacular, and the buildings are really, really beautifully maintained wooden buildings that are both ancient and freshly cared for. There are monks training there, and then it's set up so people can visit. And the twain do not so much meet, because the intensity of practice is serious. You know, sometimes people say, like, oh, we're training people here at MZMC like they train young monks in Japan. And I'm like, not really. And so, like, we're standing outside the sealed door where they're like, the Sodo, which means the monks' hall, is behind that door. And behind that door, there are a bunch of platforms, which are about the size, a little bit smaller than a twin bed, which is where the monks sleep, eat, and practice meditation. So that's about 14 hours of their day. And all their possessions live on a little headboard at the end of that platform. And the rest of the day, they're out there cleaning things meticulously, or sometimes doing really beautiful ceremonies, which we got to be a small part of. And was so beautiful. Chanting, beyond all chanting. Except the chanting here on Wednesday night during the Shuso ceremony. I was like, yeah, record this. Oh, that was really good. We had about 50 people in here. Oh, it's good. Yeah, so a couple of years of intense training is very standard of this kind of very intense monastic training to become a priest and go forth in the world. They stand outside the door in sandals in the snow for a while before they'll even let them into the temple. I don't know. I'm not like planning to reproduce this, but I'm just reporting back. So anyway, we're at the Nisodo, which is the head women's training temple with Aoyama Rochi. And she's talking about a lot of things. She's famous for flower arranging. Like when we walked in, I didn't really realize this. And the first thing she did is showed us the flower arrangement on the wall. And I was like, oh, that's nice. I probably should have realized how meaningful it was. She showed us an art book she has, like a coffee table book of her flower arrangements. And everything's like in, it's wrong. Woven in many colors of brocade. So the one I remember is she said, see this? You normally have a beautiful vase, there are particular styles for different styles of flower arranging in Japan, which is very refined. This one was in a noodle strainer, a colander, sitting in a like a hole in the ground. She's like, yep, flower arrangement. So she was really into telling us about all the bizarre flower arrangements she does and showed us lots of pictures. And then she said, it's so important to be playful, to be playful. That's how you find joy. You have to find surprise. Respond to the moment. She was. Some people are kind of charismatic. Well, she is one of them. So I was like, wow, yeah, I gotta be playful. I don't even know how right now, because. This is a little ironic though, because she's been the abbot of Nisodo for 50 years. And like 2 weeks before I went to a talk that was hosted by the Soto Zen Buddhist Association as part of our, I'll call it our because I'm on the board and the organizing committee, 2024 year of celebrating the Voices of Women in Zen series. And this talk, we have monthly talks. So this talk was by Chimyo Atkinson, who some of you know, she's come here a couple times to give talks, usually online. And she's quite wonderful. And so we said, would you give a talk for the series? She said, yes. So what do you want to talk about? She said, I want to talk about training at the Misodo. Okay. So she came and gave a talk about the training at the Misodo. And about two-thirds of the way through the talk, which was about how super intense, challenging, frustrating, and hardcore the practice was at the Misodo, I thought, is she ever going to tell us why this was helpful? Because there was so much to talk about, how hard it was, how she came in and no one would tell her anything. And she just trying to follow people and figure out, she doesn't speak Japanese, she's never been to Japan. And they're like, you just come into the space and you follow the bodies, you're gonna find your way. And wow, and how that challenged herself and how, you know, cleaning for hours a day, like what she was like, why am I cleaning this? It's already clean. Kojima Roshi gives an amazing talk about why you clean things that are clean. Because there's no gaining idea. You're not trying to get something else. No object. Objectless practice. If you want to meet the non-dual, how are you going to do it? By making dualities? It won't work. So anyway, Chimyo was just talking about how tough the practice was, the hours of zazen, her body aching. And finally, I was like, she just feels like she became confident, I think, being in life. That time training for a three-month ongo at the Misodo, even though it was so hard, she wanted to tell us why doing that very difficult thing enabled her to be utterly confident in being alive when things are difficult. So in case you lost the thread, Aoyama Roshi, who's the abbot of this temple, is like, just be playful, just be joyful. And everything I've ever heard about this place is how tough it is. You know, in the book about it, Paul Arai talks about all the interpersonal conflict that the nuns there have and how hard it is. So she talks a lot about the beauty of it as well. She does talk about the beauty of it. So what is this thing with this extremely strict practice that Aoyama wants to say is going to produce this joy in this play? I don't know. We were sitting for the tea with Aoyama Roshi in a room, like a reception room. And then one wall, maybe both walls, but one wall that I was facing was all Soji screens, the sliding paper screens. And so the other nuns came in and like when we sat down, they helped us find seats. They served us tea and then they disappeared. And then Aoyama was sitting on this big chair. Boom. And then every once in a while, Aoyama was talking Japanese and one of our party is Japanese American. So she was translating. But I didn't know what she was saying when she was speaking. I could get her affect, but she'd be like, ba, 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 ba. And then suddenly I hear behind the screen, someone's like, hi! And I hear feet running. So she had said something that wasn't to us, but was to someone sitting behind the screen, listening to the whole thing, who knew that this remark was directed to her, which was, go get me that thing. And then someone would run off and run back with the book, or maybe some more tea, or a treat. The screen would open, and then they'd go back behind. I've never experienced this kind of thing before. So a willingness to engage in a degree of hierarchy with which I personally would be pretty uncomfortable seemed quite amenable. I don't know. But when I talked to the nun who had been serving us afterwards, she just was so passionate about how glad she was to be there. She'd been there for years. So one thing I really noticed is that usually, though not always, in Japan, you have community temples like Kojima Roshi's, where there's an abbot and sort of a web of people in relationship who do things, and then a community that comes there for ceremonies, that comes there for ceremony. On the other hand, you have training temples where people are sitting zazen for hours and they're in silence. Well, guess what? We don't have that distinction around here. There are no full training temples in Minnesota. There are some elsewhere in the United States. And even them have a little bit more of the community vibe. Although most of those big training temples, they welcome visitors to come through a part of the building and get tours and stuff. But anyway, it is really worth remembering as a community that it's a strange thing to have an institution that is both just a community temple where there are people who've never been here before in that room over there, many of them probably at the introduction to meditation. And we also train people all the way through full authority to teach. That is a weird, I mean, how many cultural institutions do you know? It's like, and then we all just hang out together. So there's like two Dharma transmitted teachers listening to this talk right now. And I don't know, I recognize a lot of maybe some folks who've never been here. That's just a weird arrangement. And I am literally amazed week in and week out that it works as well as it does. Because all kinds of things could be weird about it, you know? But I practiced here and some of my peers, now I'm the teacher and they're not. What's that's awkward, you know? So anyway, I feel good about doing it. But you know, it does. If you're like, well, why do we do all this hardcore stuff here? You shouldn't be doing that. Do we want to train people with some degree of relationship to how they've been trained in this tradition for hundreds of years? I mean, we're not, you know, quite as no one's behind the screen, but hi. But I really appreciate the attendant brought this lectern here. Thank you. That's beautiful. We make our own way of doing it. Thank you, Aaron. I think I just want to read a little bit short thing here. I'm opening in this book. At the beginning of Zazen meditation, when all is still, the sound of the valley stream is loud and clear. When we walk slowly after meditation to ease leg pains and drowsiness, the sound of the stream seems to be less audible. When Zazen is completed, the sound cannot be heard at all. Why should this be? So you can replace birds or traffic, the sound of traffic. The sound of the valley stream does not actually increase, diminish, or disappear. When the waves in our minds become calm, we can hear the voices of the water, pebbles, grasses, and trees, rivers, and mountains teaching us. When our thoughts are occupied with events outside this moment, these non-sentient beings cease their speech. Rather, it is not that they no longer speak. But when we are caught up by the outer world, we have no ears to hear. So I've been working for a few months on a new thing that we're going to be doing. We launched our first one with my colleague, Gia Starr Brown, who's a Christian pastor. And we're going to be, we did, and we'll be hosting more meditation practice sessions at George Floyd Square, where Gia has been very involved and I've been a little involved with the community. And we did our first meeting a few weeks ago. And I didn't know what was going to happen. We had a good group of people came, wonderful people. And afterwards we had like we served a meal and just had people, oh, what happened? And everyone was like, I never knew there were so many birds. Like over and over, go around the table, all the birds, oh, and the sound of the cars. And just listen to the cars, like a car makes so many different sounds when it drives by. I was so happy. I've done a lot of things at George Floyd Square. Many different things. But just having the opportunity to sit together and know what is actually happening in this way, in the most simple way. Really beautiful. And before I close, I'm going to tell one more story about being in Japan with a relationship that was very brief. I went to the oldest Buddhist temple in Tokyo. I had a day where I was alone because Colleen had left and I hadn't met the New York folks yet. So I thought I'll go to this oldest temple in Tokyo. And it's a beautiful temple, but it is basically like going to the Minnesota State Fair on a busy day. So there's like an alleyway of little shops and vendors selling food and trinkets and stuff. And it was wrong. Like it was hard to walk forward. And then the whole area around a few blocks, it's just people go there. It's like fun. It's a celebration. So that was surprising. But it was also like, oh, this is wonderful. People are happy. They're coming here to honor something about their heritage, I think. Something about the beauty of these buildings, and then maybe something about the compassion and the wisdom and the kindness and the connection that Buddhism represents. But anyway, it's very thronged, and I was really hungry. And I was still like, oh, where am I going to get some food? And so I saw this thing. There's this kind of food that I really want to eat that Colleen thought looked gross. I was like, I'm alone. So they take these little balls of millet and they pound basically like mochi. So it's like a round ball. And they put them on a stick, four of them on a stick, and you grill them, and then you put a sweet soy sauce on them, and then you sell them. Food on a stick! Back to the State Fair similarity. So anyway, stick. And thousands of people, I mean, thronged. And I came up to this place, and this woman, there's a huge line, like 25 people in a line. And she was individually grilling. She had like a little grill, like a window. And then she would turn it to grill the other side. And then she would turn. One after another. I didn't say, will you be my teacher? But I really enjoyed that food. So thank you all very much for your attention. And I kind of went on for a long time there. So many wonderful experiences. I welcome reflections or questions. And if you, no matter what you say, if you can say it with a full voice, so people will be able to hear you. There's a lot of people here. And two, if you can just make what you say sort of brief, so there's room for many voices. Go ahead.
The people you were interacting and communicating with, do they have much of a sense of Buddhism in America, particularly Soto Zen Buddhism in America? Or are they inquisitive?
It was pretty various. Kojima Roshi does, because he's come here once he became Koshin's teacher. He's come here to check it out. And I think he's provided some critiques, but he also seems to just be like, you got to find your way. I would say, actually, there was not a huge, people didn't ask a lot of questions about how we were practicing, which I thought was a little bit surprising, but it may have been I was peppering them with so many questions they had no time. So, yeah. I think, people are like, oh, it would be better if they were doing it like it was here. And then I also know Japanese people who are really like, oh, I would really like to bring back some of what's happening in the U.S., Japan, and people who are working on that project. So there's a lot of, I just think it'll be better if we have more relationships so we can learn from each other. Thank you. If you're online, if you raise your hand, that's good. Aaron.
Did many or any of the people you were interacting with speak English?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was pretty various. So a lot of the time, if it was Soto Zen priests, yes, because it was kind of set up so they were like, I'd be on a tour and they'd be helping us. Or and there are a lot of people who speak a little bit of Japan, English in Japan. We had part of the time we had someone with us who spoke English and Japanese who would translate. So it was kind of mixed. But a lot more people in Japan speak English than Americans speak Japanese. I'll tell you that. Right.
And to sort of reiterate a point, go back to a point. So you did not see a lot of the sort of lay practice, sounds like, of the words. If you sort of look at that balance that you said, most of it is sort of family showing up for traditional purposes, family purposes, but you did not see a sort of just general community involvement.
Well, I would say what I saw was lay practice, which was the form of going to the temple as an activity of practice. And then maybe offering incense, maybe offering gifts, maybe witnessing a ceremony. So we watched an amazing funeral ceremony at Eheiji that was unspeakably beautiful, the chanting and the movement of the people. So, but that is the practice. Yeah. Or that was the practice that I saw. Yeah, Barbara.
Having studied Buddhism here for so long, and then that first time visiting the source of what you are so passionate about, how did that affect you?
How did it affect me to go back to the source of Japanese Soto Zen? It was just really moving. You know, I was more oriented towards meeting people and learning from them and trying to forge connections and, you know, for long-term relationships possibly. But I will say, like, one moment that was really touching, we went to, oh my goodness, what is going on here? I need an attendant who will groom me. Anyway, so we went to Kinninji in Kyoto, which was the temple where Dogen Zenji practiced before he went to China. So it's a Rinzai temple, and he met his teacher Myozen there, and they traveled to China together. And we came to Kenninji Temple, and the guy who gave us the tour only spoke Japanese. And I would say one of the delights of him was he was completely patient and amused by the difficulty in communicating. No, he spoke a little English, but poorly. That was what it was. And he was just like, this is just kind of funny that it's like this. Anyway, he took us into the Kaisando at Kenninji, which is a very private place because we had some relationships with him, the founder's hall, and showed us the gravesite where Dogen Zenji brought his teacher's remains back from China. And I don't know why, you know, I don't understand why these things happen, but I was just so moved to be standing there at this gravesite that was formed 800 years ago by someone who had been with the teacher. He said, I like your teaching, but it's not good enough. And his teacher said, fine, I'll go with you to China. Let's figure it out. And then his teacher died there. He brought his remains back and buried them at Kenninji. And to stand there at that actual place was very moving. Thank you. Yes?
Did you see anything or in the local times? Was there the practice of going to
I did not. That's called takuhatsu, right? Do I have that? Am I saying that right? I didn't see it happen. I think maybe it's more common to do it as part of formal training. So, like, if you're in a training temple, it's kind of like a rite of passage. You go out, but I'm not really sure. And I didn't see anyone doing it, but it does happen. It is a living tradition.
That
would seem like a way for the community to practice the compassion. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I think so. And in Japan, it's more likely that the community members, I think, go to the temple to make the offering. But like in Southeast Asia, it's common for the monks will just go through the village and collect their food. I think it's more common there. Maybe one more thing. If there's one more thing. Okay, maybe not one more thing.
Ben?
Yes.
I have a question about the book you read from.
Yep.
Is that written by the 91-year-old
yeah.
teacher?
Yeah, it's a book by Shundo Aoyama Roshi. It's called Zen Seeds. It's actually translated by Diane Benage, you know her, who died. No, she did not. Sorry. Yes. Diane. Not good. She's quite elderly. So, anyway, great book. Highly recommend it. And thanks for just listening to me kind of rove through some memories, try and pull something forth that maybe can inform how we see our relationship to tradition, to other people, to some cultural differences. And then make our little effort. Maybe just to enjoy some raindrops or some ducks. Or just hear some cars at George Floyd Square. It's a good effort. Well, thank you very much. I'll turn it over to our dog.